1967 and 1968, pretty vivid years in the history of Detroit. In 67, racial tensions boiled over one hot July night on 12th Street. And then the following year saw baseball fans, black and white, coming together at the corner of Michigan and Trumbull, rooting the Tigers on to a World Series win over the Cardinals. That is the setting for the new novel, Motor City Burning. Author Bill Morris blends the riot, the World Series, and the city of Detroit into a new murder mystery. Welcome, Bill.
Well, thank you, Cindy.
What inspired you to want to take a deep dive and explore those 2 years in Detroit?
Well, I guess it's the fact that I lived through it. I was a teenager at the time in Detroit, and I remember the riot vividly. I remember the World Series and that wonderful 68 baseball season. I went to one of the World Series games, sat in the right field upper deck. They got beat by the Cardinals that day, unfortunately. But I thought, if I can find a way to weave these two summers together and tell that story, I think I'll have a good book. And that's what I tried to do through the eyes of a young black man up from Alabama. I knew I wanted to have a black protagonist in the story, and I've needed to get away, figure out a way to get him involved in the riot. And I ended up doing that, and then wove the summer of 67 into the summer of 68.
And you did a great job knitting that all together. So tell us about Willie Bledsoe, first of all. We'll talk about
Willie. Well, Willie Bledsoe is a young black guy from a little town in southern Alabama, went to Tuskegee Institute for 1 year and got swept up in the movement and dropped out of school. He had a snug berth at Tuskegee, and his parents told him to stay in school. And he said, no, I got to go do this.
The movement being?
The movement being the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He was a freedom rider. He was on the bus that burned outside of Anniston. Got his lips split open at the riot at Montgomery bus station. And he becomes very disillusioned with the movement along about 1964, the Freedom Summer, which was 50 years ago this summer, oddly enough. And he becomes disillusioned and winds up trying to write a memoir about the movement. Can't get it done. His brother comes home from Vietnam, and his brother has a lot of guns and says, let's run these guns up to Detroit and make some money. So in his desperation, he does it, a foolish thing. But he winds up getting involved in the riot, and we learn this in the first chapter of the book. In the last chapter of the book, we learn exactly what happened on that fateful night when the last person got killed, the 43rd victim during the riot.
And then take us into the life of Detroit Police Detective Frank Doyle. Who is he, and tell us about that case?
Well, he's on the case because he grew up in Jefferson Chalmers on the east side of Detroit, and there was a market at the corner of his street called the Greenleaf Market, run by a couple of the Hulls, who he was very, very much enamored of as a kid. Helen Hull was living at the Harlan House Motel on Grand Boulevard during the riot because the neighborhood was on fire, and Mr. Hull wanted to get her out of there. And she stood in a window on West Grand Boulevard and got shot through the chest. This is historical fact, which I've woven into the fictional part of the story. Frank Doyle is I made him up out of whole cloth.
But you didn't make her up.
No, and she was Vic number 43. She was the last unsolved murder from the riot, and Frank Doyle, who knew her as a boy running that market, is determined to find her killer. And he believes that Willie Bledsoe may have pulled the trigger, but definitely was involved in getting the guns to the spot where the shot was fired. And this is the mystery that he's trying to solve.
So that's where we meet him initially, was a year later, and he's still trying to crack this case.
He's a pit bull. He's on it, and he won't let go.
The old Tiger Stadium, the Michigan and Trumbull corner, is a pretty important character in Motor City Burning, and you don't waste any time getting us right there in the middle of a Tigers game. And I'm wondering, would you read us an excerpt? And this is when Willie Bledsoe goes to a game at Tiger Stadium, and it appears this is his first time.
Yeah, he's going to his first Major League Baseball game in his life. Again, remember, he's from southern Alabama. He's been in Detroit for a few months, about 9 months. But he's never been to a big league baseball game. And oddly enough, the first game of the 1968 season was postponed by 2 days by President Johnson in deference to Martin Luther King's funeral. And Willie's thinking about Martin Luther King as he walks to the ballpark. He's parked his car on Plum Street in Corktown. So as Willie waited in line at the ticket window, new smells came to him. Windborne ash and cinders from the city's smokestacks, a vaguely briny smell off the river, diesel exhaust from idling buses. And then, after he paid 50 cents for a bleacher seat and began ascending the switchbacks that carried fans from the street to the upper deck, I've made that climb a few times, he realized he was climbing into a symphony of smells, a single, complex aroma that had been composing itself since the first baseball game was played 56 Aprils ago in this, America's oldest big league ballpark. It was equal parts mustard, sweat, stale beer, urine, popcorn, wet wool, vomit, perfume, cigar smoke, and boiled pork. It was that musty smell iron gives off after it has stood in one place through 56 scorching summers, 56 Arctic winters, and an unknowable number of sleet storms and baseball games and football games, halftime pageants and fist fights and pennant drives, after it has absorbed the shuffling of millions of pairs of feet, heard the guttural animal roar of cheers and boos and taunts, after it has housed the whole range of human emotions, from ecstasy to scorn to despair, that touched the lives of people who live in a sports-mad city like Detroit. He was winded when he reached the upper deck. Pausing to catch his breath, he told himself winter was over and he needed to get back out on the basketball court. He noticed something on the concession stand menus called Red Hots, and the cryptic words, "Crush all cups," stenciled on the walls at regular intervals. He had entered a house of mysteries and secret codes. The bleachers were reached by long catwalks suspended by cables from riveted iron girders. Looking down gave him a mild sense of vertigo, so he lifted his eyes to the rectangle of blue sky before him. He saw seagulls, and then he stepped into the sunshine. Arrayed before him was the most beautiful room he'd ever seen. It was painted green, this irregular open-air room, its upper deck seats sheltered by a tar-paper roof, the field a luxuriously cross-hatched emerald carpet. The infield dirt was tinged with something black. Coal dust? The bases glowed like sugar cubes. He climbed toward the big black scoreboard at the top of the bleachers, toward the huge AC spark plug shooting through a ring of fire. From up there he could see the spires of downtown, but he turned his back on the skyline and studied this lovely open-air room. The longer he gazed out at the park, the smaller it seemed to become. It was hard to believe the place could hold upwards of 50,000 people. It was so intimate.
Anyone who's been to Tiger Stadium can go, "I was there. That's exactly what it was like." Just terrific.
I hope so.
Author Bill Morris reading from his new novel, Motor City Burning, a crime novel. You know, Bill, I lived through that era living in the Detroit area, and I found that the vintage Detroit details that you're able to lace through the book, they're absolutely astounding. And I know you spent those years in Detroit, but still, how'd you get it so right?
Memory, certainly, but also a lot of research. I came back to Detroit from various places that I've been living all over the world and spent a lot of time at the public library, reading city directories, getting the names of stores on 12th Street, reading old microfilm of newspapers, walking the streets where I knew I wanted to set my scenes, the buildings where the sniper was on the roof, walked on, up and down 12th Street where the riot had been. Some of the stores, of course, are gone. Some are still there. So I walked the streets. I read the histories. I read a ton of books about Detroit. And like you say, memory. We both remember the 60s. We were alive and in the city at the time. And it was a long time ago, but some stuff doesn't leave you.
Well, with that in mind, I think about that the 67 riots are such a crucial part of this story. And so many of us who will read the book, those memories are vivid. I remember my father, the fire captain from Ferndale. We didn't see him for days because he was putting out fires on Kercheval. I remember that extremely vividly. Why is it you think that still has such a hold on us?
The riot itself? I think it's got to be the single most important thing that's happened in Detroit, bigger than the automobile. Certainly it resonates to this day. A lot of people seem to think that Detroit went to hell because of the riot. And Detroit was in a state of decline for a decade and a half. Population was leaving Detroit. You know, the myth that the riot ruined Detroit is simply wrong. And I wanted to correct that. The myth that Coleman Young ruined Detroit is also wrong. And that's another book I'm working on now. But that was such a horrific, cataclysmic summer. And the city is still obviously not all the way over it. And I think it's a coming to grips with it is something I wanted to try to do in this book. I'm not sure I succeeded, but I certainly wanted to tell it from different perspectives, from the perspective of a black man and from a white cop. And they're very different ideas about this same event. You can talk to any two Detroiters, you're going to get a different story about what happened that summer. And that's what I wanted to try to get at.
With that in mind, I'd like, if you would, you do such a great job of reading, if you'd read us a passage where Detective Frank Doyle is driving through his old precinct. This is after he heads out from police headquarters right downtown in Beaubien, and he's heading north on Woodward.
So he turned left onto Boston, a boulevard of fading but still grand mansions. The grandest of them all was off to his right, a three-story palace roosting on a green carpet that was being groomed by black men riding a fleet of little tractors. Country living right here in the heart of the Motor City. Barry Gordy, the founder of Motown Records, had paid $1 million for the place last year, and the understanding around town was that he'd done so to squelch rumors that the company was planning to move to L.A. But Doyle had his doubts, and he wasn't alone. $1 million was beer money to a guy like Berry Gordy. Besides, why shouldn't a thriving record company join the exodus? Did it have an obligation to hang on just because it happened to be owned by a black man? Did Ford Motor Company have a similar obligation just because old Henry made his pots of money here? Nobody squawked when he took his show out to Snow White Dearborn. After crossing over the Lodge Freeway, Doyle turned left onto 12th Street, where it had all started. The gutted building still looked warm to the touch, like the fires had stopped burning 9 hours and not 9 months ago. Very few of them had been torn down yet, as though someone, insurance companies, the white power structure, had left them standing as perverse monuments to the madness that had swept the city. Those that had been torn down had usually been replaced by nothing at all, just pebbly, weed-choked lots that glittered more brightly every day with smashed wine and liquor bottles. Ragweed acres, Doyle called these vistas. Businesses along 12th Street that were untouched or only brushed by the flames had usually been modified, windows filled in with bulletproof bricks or cinder blocks, a hideous but necessary architectural trend known locally as Riot Renaissance. Driving through his old precinct never failed to depress Doyle. He'd spent 3 years of his 7 years in uniform patrolling this neighborhood, and he'd grown fond of it. It had never been plush, but it was always solid, working class, and there were still many blocks where people owned their homes, trimmed their hedges and lawns, went to church, belonged to the Block Association, the UAW, the NAACP, but they were being nibbled away. Since the riot, whites and many better-off blacks hadn't been able to get out fast enough.
That's Bill Morris reading from his new crime novel, Motor City Burning. You could teach us a lesson in patience and persistence in what it took to get this story published. How long did it take?
Oh, only 17 little years. Yeah, I started writing this book back in 1996, and it went through, let me think, 4 titles, 4 agents, about a dozen major rewrites, and I'm going to say conservatively 50 rejections before finally somebody realized how brilliant it is.
There's a lesson there. Don't give up.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. All right.
Now, do you see Willie or Frank Doyle in future stories?
I'd like to see Willie again. I'm not so sure about Doyle, but Willie was, you know, he was in his 20s back in the 60s, and I'm thinking he left Detroit at the I don't want to give too much away, but he's got a bright future, and I'd like to see him back in Detroit maybe in the 70s, maybe when Coleman Young is mayor. So I'm thinking along those lines for maybe the next book.
I'm wondering, Bill, what challenges did you face in capturing the speech of your black characters in the Detroit of 67? Was that tough?
Well, yeah, it was. But, you know, I tell you, I was down in Atlanta. An elderly black lady who grew up in Detroit was at my reading there. And she had finished reading the book. And she said, "Mr. Morris, when I was reading this book, and I realized how you got inside the mind of this black character, Willie Bledsoe, and the way that people were talking," she said, "I had to keep looking at your picture in the back of the book to keep remembering that you're white." And I said, "Well, I am white." And I said, "Ma'am, you've just paid me the highest compliment a writer could get, because that's the job of a writer, is to try to get inside of his characters' minds. And whether they're black or white or male or female or gay or straight or Christian or Muslim, I don't care. If you're a good writer, you're able to get into that person's mind and empathize with them rather than looking at them as from a voyeuristic point from outside. So that's what novelists try to do. And I'm not so sure I succeeded. That lady seemed to think so, and I was very flattered by that. But yes, it's difficult to imagine the lives of other people, but I think that's what we all need to do more of.
Yeah. And by the way, I think it would be interesting to have Willie be working in the Coleman Young administration somehow.
Now
could
we're
be
talking.
An idea. What's ahead for you now?
Well, now I do some more traveling. I've driven a couple thousand miles from New York to Atlanta up to Detroit, and I got some more readings, and then I'm going to go back and start another book.
And speaking of readings, Bill's got some coming up in the Southeast Michigan and Northern Michigan area, including tomorrow night he will be reading from his book and making an appearance at Nicola's in Ann Arbor. That's at 7 p.m. And this Sunday at Book Beat in Oak Park. That's at 6 p.m. And there are other dates coming up, Petoskey, Birmingham. We have all the details for you at our website at michiganradio.org. Bill, it was a blast talking with you, as fun as it was to read the book. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Cindy.